That's fair enough. I think that's probably the best way of kind of doing it. That's kind of why I'm wigging it, because it's like, all right, okay, what names are going to jump out? And, yeah, there's a... I think that it's kind of stupid now to separate the men and women.
Yeah, fair call, I guess. I think, though, I have a point to make about that.
No, I probably know what your point is, in the roles and the so like the history and the lineage of, you know, what a female actor could do in the past has changed so much to now that there would have been a lot of great actors that just didn't have that those opportunities.
Yeah, but roles haven't been as good, and I still mean, probably aren't.
Kind of Audrey Hepburn going from Breakfast at Tiffany's sort of thing to I've forgotten the name of it. There was a really cool thriller where she was blind. Alone in the Dark? No, not Alone in the Dark. Something.
Is this like Audrey that. Or Catherine?
I'm pretty sure it's Audrey, but it may have been Catherine. I may be getting my
Hepburns
mixed up, which is a common problem. But it was fucking awesome, and it was really quite different to what she had done. It was
Charade?
No. It was something in like the mid to late 70s?
Wait Until Dark?
Oh, yes, that's it. Wait Until Dark.
1967. There we go.
Fuck.
That would be it. Mm. A recently blinded woman is terrorized by a trio of thugs.
Mm. It's really good.
This is also something else I'll talk about it when we get live. Yeah, but like, I feel like Marlon Brando should be on the list.
Yeah.
But I can honestly say I remember three, maybe four Marlon Brando films.
Mm.
And one of them is The Island of Dr. Moreau, and the other one is The Score. You remember the Ed Norton?
Mm.
And neither of those...
Frank Oz movie, yeah.
Yeah, they weren't, that wasn't good.
Mm.
And so, you got The Godfather, and you got Apocalypse Now. I'm like,
I had the same thing with Anthony Hopkins. It's like, okay, Silence of the Lambs, but no one remembers him for Hannibal, for the movie Hannibal, and... Has he really done another iconic role? He's an actor,
He's solid.
But...
No, I suggest not. I would suggest he's exactly someone who's scaled insanely high heights.
Mm.
But then did films like, I don't know, what, Solace and Hearts in Atlantis and...
And what was that?
Mission Impossible.
Oh, fuck, he did Bad Company with Chris Rock.
Riley! Where are you, mate?
He's just under there. He's just relaxing.
I'm going to have to kick you out, aren't I?
I'm
going
to bring up that article...
Right,
so,
me.
Got it. Yeah.
Sit.
All right.
Danny.
Greetings and salutations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Armchair Producers. My name is George Tarrant, and I am joined, as always, by the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Travis Croft. How are you on this muggy day?
I am fine and dandy. Further week down in Melbourne summer.
Yes. How did you handle yesterday? Because it got up to like 44 degrees.
It was fine at work, but you must say Thursday was tricky. It was a Saturday here in famous Electric Fried Brain Studios, Electric Ham Sandwich Studios. Thursday was also well over 40, I guess, for our northern, our backwards American listeners, who are the only people in the world who use the scale they do, over 100. And the air conditioning was off and on in the office all day, so... apparently it was busted. Someone had to go up and push a button every time it switched itself off.
Oh, jeez.
So it was like, on the one hand, it was very stuffy inside the office. But it was also, if you've ever worked inside an office, there's always the hum of something, like an air conditioner. And the fact that the office goes deadly silent without that white noise,
it's
very off-putting.
should someone just hum or something?
I feel like I should put some music on or something. You know, like, it's so quiet. I actually worked in an office that didn't have air conditioning because it was a big modern building, you know, 5-star, 6-star energy rated building.
Oh, yeah.
And so they just had hot, cold water pipe through pipes, and that was to...
Oh,
and it worked the same sort of, at least I think that was the idea.
Mm.
But so there was no pumping air conditioning.
Mm.
So, but they actually found that it was so detrimental to productivity to have an office that quiet. They actually had special speakers
to simulate
the white noise.
I guess it... Maybe it goes back to as far back as the womb, you know, that kind of, like, ambient noise that you hear. They kind of say, oh, yes, it's really good to kind of play that if a baby's having, like, a screaming fit or something, because it simulates being in the womb. maybe we just, like Alanis Morissette, how do we deal with silence?
Mm-hmm. Is that a song?
It's one of the lines in one of her songs off of her second album.
Jagged Little Pill was her second. The one after that.
Yeah,
the one that no one bought.
The second one after the reinvention.
Yeah, don't mention the first record.
Now, so we just want to give you, as we did last week, trying to get into this whole housekeeping thing, promoting ourselves a little bit more. So don't forget, you can join in with the show by going to facebook.com/groups/FriedBrainProductions and or follow us on Twitter @EvilTrav or @TheFriedBrain. If you've got any questions, comments, concerns, anything like that, hit us up and we'll talk them through and see if we can solve some problems in this wonderful world.
Be like an agony aunt.
Yes.
So I can't get laid. What do I do?
Agony third uncle, twice removed.
And he's a physiotherapist.
Yes. But as I mentioned last week, for all non-Apple heathens, Armchair Producers is now available on SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Wooshka. So please head on over, subscribe, even if you're not using those services. It just helps with a little bit of visibility. So if you'd like to do that, that'd be really awesome. And you know what? We are actually considered a viable torture that is not illegal. Just getting people to...
According to my contacts at Guantanamo Bay, we go down quite well.
That is true. That is true. They get some good answers. You know, 5 minutes in, perfect.
5 minutes of our conversation about Ghostbusters again, and they're like, no, not again!
Well, that leads into a little segue. We have been talking behind the scenes, and we're going to be doing a little bit of a promotion because we are officially on patreon.com/FriedBrainProductions, where for $1 a month, you can actually get every episode a week earlier than every other podcasting service. So why not? And you can cancel at any time as well. So it's good. The next tier, which is... a little bit more special. It's $5 a month, but not only do you get all the episodes early, but we're doing a one a month special where we're going to do a deep dive topic, and that topic is revisiting the greatest box office flops of all time. So we're going to go through, we're going to have a real in-depth conversation about the pre-production, production, initial release, audience response, and whether they are worthy of their flop status or if they are like misunderstood gems, badly marketed. What
went wrong?
Yeah, essentially.
I mean, just to give an example, I think we're going to work down the list off...
We're going to go alphabetical off of Wikipedia.
His biggest box office bomb. Mm-hmm. So I think I can give you a sneak preview that the first cab off the rank will be the Antonio Banderas.
Yes.
Helmed. The 13th Warrior.
13th Warrior.
From 1999, which is currently listed as the biggest box office bomb, I think, is it? No, it's alphabetical.
No, it's alphabetical. So it's the biggest, depending on inflation, the biggest is one of my personal favorites, and we will get to it, John Carter, which arguably lost up to $200 million.
Adjusted for inflation, they say the 13th Warrior lost up to $190 million.
Ooh.
That's pretty hardcore. But, I mean, if you look down the list... Blade Runner 2049 is in the list. It currently is estimated to have lost $80 million.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we both agree that that's one of the best films I've seen in years.
Yes.
So there's an example of a film where, what went wrong? Why is Blade Runner on the same list? And the next one after that will be Catwoman.
Yeah.
So there's
an interesting dichotomy, and they go back, I think there's some as far back as like the late 60s.
1967, yeah. I see Dr. Doolittle, fall, 1964,
yeah.
Fall of the Roman Empire.
So we're going to get quite a quite an interesting slice of genres, time periods of cinema, as well as kind of audience tastes and things like that. So it's going to be interesting. For those of you who have listened to us through G&T Podcasts as well as this, we are going to be having to revisit some truly terrible movies, such as Ghostbusters from 2016. That's going to be fun.
A lot of these I actually haven't seen. Some we have. Mm. I think you had to watch the 2002 Chris Klein Rollerball reboot for one of our horrible movie challenges.
But The Man from U.N.C.L.E., we saw that
at the movies.
Yes, we did. I think that it's going to be quite good. We're going to take it a little bit more seriously, a little bit more directed compared to this show. So the first one will be up fairly soon. We want to just get a couple recorded so that we can make sure we're hitting each month. So for the time being, if you do want to help support us, just click on $1 level and you'll get everything that we get. And then obviously as soon as the first episode hits, you'll be able to up your Patreon if you do so wish. But, it's potentially going to be video as well, if we can get that sorted out and people are actually remotely interested in seeing our ugly faces.
We did do one before, for those who remember. I think the original podcast
one,
number 10.
Episode 10 Spectacular,
which
yes.
is now lost, episode 10 Spectacular. Is it lost?
No, it's on YouTube.
Oh, okay.
It's somewhere on YouTube. It's
lost in the wilds
and there
of YouTube.
Was, I think there was either episode 2 or 3 of Rebranding for Armchair Producers, where we tried to do video
work.
And it just didn't work. It's like, nah.
So many people seem to get this right. Like, I see so many Twitch streamers, and they're like, and they got like green screens of shit, and you're like, Christ.
Like, okay, they look professional, but we will keep our level of amateur, but the content will be good.
So it's something to look forward to, a 13th Warrior. I've not seen it, so.
I remember seeing it. Least once. I may have seen it twice. But, on with the show. So, should we start with usual, what we've been watching and playing?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay. Do you want to go first?
I will start. I've had a busy week at work, but I managed to squeeze a couple of noobs in, which are things that we haven't talked about before, and one that we'll be revisiting. Yeah. Life, and a recommendation of a friend, started watching Manhunt Unabomber on Netflix.
Okay.
Which is the Sam Worthington, Paul Bettany drama, crime drama about, funnily enough, the Unabomber.
I would never have guessed.
You would never have guessed. It's kind of a dumb title. And Sam Worthington, where the fuck did he go after Avatar? And
he did Clash of the Titans and then Wrath of the Titans. And there was
a lot of nothing.
Man on a Ledge, I think, which was a weird heist, sort of heist movie.
This is—he's okay in this. He plays a newly graduated criminal profiler who's assigned to the Unabomber case.
Okay,
he's not taken very seriously by profiling, despite this being the '90s. I kind of remember profiling being a thing by the '90s, but his profile, his skills are not taken very seriously by the task force led by wonderfully actually by Chris Noth, looking very old.
I know the name.
Chris Noth was Mr. Big in Sex and the City. He was in Law and Order, Criminal Intent for a few seasons. You'll definitely know the face. His picture on IMDb is weird.
why is it a picture of an anus?
Yes, exactly. He was in Arse and Arse 2. He's not taken very seriously. Mm. And the story continues to flash between his work on the actual task force hunting for the Unabomber Ted Kaczynski against we cut in time to in the future him being trying to, the FBI trying to coax him back into the fold of into the case to try and get caught Unabomber plead guilty so that they can avoid a trial and to make sure it's a slam dunk, so to speak. So we have that time dichotomy between jumping forwards and backwards in time. It's actually a really slow burner.
Okay.
Like the first half an hour, I'm like, what the fuck are these people telling me? This show's really good.
Is that intentional?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I'm happy with a slow burning story, but what was slow burning for me was like, it seemed really cliche and tropey. If that's a word, is that a word? Tropey.
It works. It works.
And that doesn't go away. But once the story starts to get interesting and we learn a little bit, we start to, if you stick at it, which I did, and I actually found myself this morning, I think up to about episode 4, and you're like, actually, I just want to keep smashing. There's only 8 episodes.
Okay.
But it just gets irritating in parts because they'll do that thing where, he's the unappreciated guy who we know is going to crack the case because he's Sam Worthington. The other guys are like, you go in your room and do your stupid science stuff. We'll be police and do normal police work. And, I don't trust you, you eggheads. You know what I mean?
I feel like this would be a weird combination of Clarice Starling and Starsky and Hutch.
or with a black chief from Last Action Hero. it's a bit like, it's a bit of a trope where, like, the unappreciated genius would be in, like, his hotel room and have photos spread out all over the floor and you'd just be sitting there looking at them. You know what I mean? That's such a classic police, you know, serial killer movie thing, or he'll probably be grumpily talking about something. Oh, we can't crack this case. Rah, rah, rah. And they'll throw down a piece of paper or a book or whatever, looking at you.
A cup will break and it's like Kobayashi.
Or something like that. It'll be like, you just open the land or open on a page and you look at it and go, whoa, you know, we mean, this is what we've been looking for, and I just happened to notice it now.
That sounds like a very typical crutch for any kind of cop drama that would appear on ABC.
Yeah,
like it's... Castle was infamous for that.
It's kind of, it's so it's full of that stuff, or like his hotel room's got poached, it's, you know, wallpapered with photos and documents with things circled and stuff like
the
that.
The orgy of evidence.
And you're like, does it... if you're a police officer or a detective, you'd be like, everybody does that. I don't know. Maybe they do. I don't know.
Maybe they do. Everyone's kind of going, oh my God, it's so accurate.
I was just like waiting for it to be a scene where you've got pieces of string between stuff, you know, like, it didn't happen, but there are four episodes to go. Okay. So look, it's good. It's just, you just gotta, when I compare it to a show like Mindhunter, which I watched a few months ago,
that's, you smashed that.
I really... Yeah. I mean, I could smash this as well, but it's not of a class of Mindhunter. It's not as cleverly written.
Who is it directed by? Is it different for each episode? Or?
Actually, no. The series is directed by a guy named Greg Yatanis, who I've never heard of.
The reason I ask is, I mean, David Fincher was the mastermind behind Mindhunters.
Mm.
Kind of a hard act to kind of...
True. I mean, this is a guy who's directed a lot of TV. Ray Donovan, House, Damages, Heroes, Lost, that kind of thing. Prison Break. So, yeah, he's not in the league of someone like Fincher. But it's just lazy in parts. And you're like, couldn't you think of something better to have him do than do that? And you're like, I'm enjoying the story. And, you know, Paul Bettany plays Ted Kaczynski.
Okay.
And he's almost unrecognizable in parts, and he's doesn't. Paul Bettany's a fine actor, right? Underrated, I think.
Yeah. Where did you find this?
This on Netflix.
Okay.
So it was apparently going to be called Manifesto, and they decided on Manhunt Unabomber. So,
gee, which one's the better? I feel like that needs to go on a poll.
The only thing I feel like is that maybe if they go, and this is like they see this is maybe the first in a series. A little bit like the underbelly shows in Australia, and so it'll be like Manhunt Bundy and Manhunt Dahmer, or
it could end up becoming like an anthology series,
or like American Horror Story,
Coven and all that jazz.
Also this week we've had, just in the last couple weeks, I should say, we've had the return of Star Trek Discovery for the second half. I'll talk, and then you can give your impressions as well.
Chime in.
We have. Almost a two-part return of two episodes that come landing back after the, what do they call it, the mid-season break?
Yeah.
And it's an interesting angle. At the end of the last, first half of this season, Discovery had done some funky shit with their spore drive.
Yeah.
And
kind of. Spoilers, I guess.
Well, I mean, it was 2 months ago.
Yeah.
Fuck, it was...
you've either watched it...
It was November.
Yeah.
Come on.
Carry on.
If you don't want to learn anymore, stop now.
Just skip forward 5 minutes.
And they found themselves oh no, we can't tell where we are.
Mm-hmm.
Their engineer was catatonic.
Yep.
And you're like, oh my God, what's going to happen? And what happened is a very classic Star Trek maneuver. Mm-hmm. It's almost yesterday's Enterprise. There's themes of, I can't remember the original series episode where they visit a parallel universe.
Yeah, with the evil Spock.
Evil Spock and stuff like that, and funky uniforms. So this is not exactly fresh territory for Trek fans, but
it's a Trek.
It's for Trek anyway.
Yeah.
It's good though. I really quite enjoyed it. So the Enterprise, it's not the Enterprise, the Discovery, has found itself in a parallel universe where the galaxy is ruled by the evil and oppressive Terran Empire.
No relation.
you should totally have trademarked that.
Terran Empire. I don't think I'll be able to get away with it because there are one or two sci-fi movies where everything is referred to as the Terran Empire.
So to get their first goal is to sort of get back to their own sort of time frame or their own parallel universe, and to discover that somehow some other Federation ship has entered the that parallel universe before.
Mm.
So they decided...
The one that got destroyed.
The Defiant.
Yes, that's right.
Which is interesting, because there is a very famous Defiant in
Deep Space Nine,
but yeah. I don't believe it's the same ship. At least the picture didn't look the same.
It would be interesting.
It would have. I was thinking, ooh, yeah. Crossover!
Yeah.
But no, I don't think so. Mm. We'll see. So they have to infiltrate the Shenzo, which is the original ship that this theory started with, and try and retrieve data about that ship so they can try and escape back to the normal time. And all sorts of shit, of course, goes wrong.
They've got their doppelgangers, and there's sort of like weird perversions of their own selves in different situations of life.
Who's the captain's some interesting, I'll leave it a little bit of mystery there, but yeah. I mean, like, there's some interesting captaincy moves, at the same time as all this stuff's going on, Ash Tyler, the security officer who is sort of involved with Michael Burnham, is starting to discover some messed up shit about his past.
Yeah.
And so he's going through an interesting time, and at the same time, he's a sort of crucial part in this plot to get this information off the Shenzo back to the Discovery, and so they can get back to their normal time.
Yes.
I really enjoyed it, despite the fact, like I said, they're kind of derivative of previous Trek parallel universe adventures. I still massively enjoyed these episodes, and they're really starting to heat up. And I think, again, spoilers, people, we're starting to see that. They talked up before the season started, that they'd be a little bit more Game of Thronesy about it, a little bit more Walking Dead inspired, in that major characters will and can die.
Yeah, I feel like I don't think there's anyone who I feel watching it is completely immune to the possibility of death. Even Michael, I feel like she's probably got the most likelihood of survival, but the situation that she's finding herself in now,
that's a doozy of a pickle.
Yeah, that's gonna be an interesting one. And if they were to kind of go, nope, to tell the best story, she's got to die. Like, okay, I'm down with it because I'm enjoying the story that she's on. I'm enjoying that journey.
It will be disappointing because she is the breakout star. She's
fucking fantastic. Yeah.
She's Sonequa Martin-Green is amazing. I think she was on the Orange is the New Black. No, she was on The Walking Dead. Wrong one.
Yes.
And I think she's going to be a big, big star after... Well, I mean, hopefully she breaks out and does some big film work after this. So,
yeah.
But, you know, no one else really stands out. Like, I mean, Jason Isaacs, I think, is starting to really come into his own. Mary Wiseman as Sylvia Tilly's got an interesting little mini arc, and I think she's adorable.
Doug Jones is completely unrecognizable.
As Saru, but he's always unrecognizable. He's always
unrecognizable. I just hope he's the go-to man for Guillermo.
Is he going to be in the new Hellboy films? I hope so.
Maybe. I don't know.
He's got a big role coming out very soon in The Shape of Water.
I cannot wait for that movie.
That's going to be good, but it's another story.
Discovery, I'm really fucking loving the production quality. I'm loving the acting. I think everyone is doing a really good job on that, kind of inhabiting their characters. The emotional kind of roller coaster for Paul Stamets' character and his relationship with Dr. Hugh Culber. That's really cool. It's not cliched or cheesy or anything like that. None of the relationships are too cliched or like, oh, that's a reskin of this one. They've got their own unique twists on it. Jason Isaacs is fucking awesome. It's one of the few shows where I'm watching it each week kind of going, I don't quite know where they're going to go with this.
It is. It's true. And it's not your mama's Star Trek. I feel like it's actually an incredibly bold move by the producers and the writers and everybody involved, because I know a lot of hardcore Trek fans feel pretty alienated and turned off by some of the angles and directions the show's gone on. So, and that's so to sort of sideline your hardcore audience because you feel that's so you can serve the story in a way you really feel it should be served.
Yeah,
is really bold television, and I think that's probably why it's so good.
Yeah, it's going to be kind of interesting to see if the reaction and critical response of this show will inform what they do with the movies at all, because they are at a point where they've they're derivative of themselves. They've done the reboot. The first one was well received. The second one was The Force Awakens for Star Trek. Where, all right, we've done this. There's a little bit of difference. It's not really particularly exciting. People who like it. People who don't really don't. The third one was generally rather panned.
Ugh.
It was fine. It wasn't Star Trek, and it didn't make much sense.
We've ranted about that recently, but...
But then, you know, the notion months ago of Tarantino coming in and doing things, I'm like, wow, that would really shake things up. But a Tarantino story and directed by Tarantino, that... I can't see that appeasing the hardcore Trek audience, much like this show.
Which is, yeah, I mean, it's maybe where they need to take it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's kind of, I mean, like, that said, that's kind of what Rian Johnson did with Star Wars recently, and, you know, I had my problems with it, but he's kind of gone, well, fuck you.
It's still made a fuck ton of money.
It's made less.
But still has made a fuck ton of money.
Yeah, so, I mean, maybe it'll be a bit of originality, might actually... Yeah. I mean, I guess the thing that they have to fight against there is that that brand, Star Trek brand, says a lot about what the film's going to be like. And 100%. And a lot of... Do people it's really want to be... It's got a reputation.
Yeah.
So, of being kind of nerdy and geeky and you know, idealistic. So, yeah. It will be interesting to see. I've seen a lot of fan-made... Tarantino Trek posters on Facebook with like Christoph Waltz and Samuel Jackson and stuff in it, and they're like, you know what, I would probably just go, I don't really care what he does, if he cast Christoph Waltz as the captain and like you know Samuel Jackson as like the security officer or something, it'd be like,
I would even be keen to see, well I wouldn't be keen, but I would happily go and see a Tarantino directed Star Trek where Adam Sandler is the director, the captain. That would be really
For
weird.
Years, there was rumors. Originally, he was going to be... Sandler was going to be in a Tarantino film. He was going to be cast in Inglourious Basterds as one of the bastards. I think in Eli Roth's role, if I'm not mistaken.
Bear Jew. I remember that.
Don't quote me on that. I'm happy to be corrected. Because also Michael Madsen at one point was involved in that film. I don't know if he's ever involved, but he was going to be involved or rumored to be involved. But... which isn't a huge leap for Tarantino, considering he's one of his guys.
Yeah.
For years, I'm pretty sure Sandler was going to be involved, but there was like a scheduling thing, and they went with Roth instead. But I still, I'm off topic of usual. Oh, but like, to see Tarantino handle someone like him, it would be great because one of the only really Sandler film I've ever enjoyed was Punch Drunk Love, which was just Sandler doing the Sandler character. But through the lens of a really, really talented director in Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah.
And that's ironically the Sandler film that most Sandler fans... Yeah. Oh, that's the one I don't like. I didn't get it.
Oh, give me fucking Happy Gilmore too.
You know, and like, so I would be keen to see that. But one other thing I did see today, just to get back on track, because everybody knows I'm a Tarantino fanboy, and I would go see him direct Christoph Waltz reading the phone book. That would be interesting.
That would be good.
Hey, hey, Aardvark. motherfucker. Today I went to the cinema and saw one of the red hot tips for this year's Academy Awards. New name of the category. This is tip to win it. It is The Post.
The Post. Now this has got a lot of Oscars clout to it.
It does. It's
production.
Roll goal. This is the blue blood of cinema. I mean, it's politics, it's got its cast, it's the whole bizzo. So I have a plot summary. A cover-up that spanned four U.S. presidents pushed the country's first female newspaper editor and a hard-driving publisher to join an unprecedented battle between the press and the government. This is essentially the story of the Pentagon Papers, if anybody's familiar with that scenario.
Okay.
There was a documentary about it a few years ago.
Right.
Essentially, a U.S. government employee named Daniel Ellsberg got a hold of some documents about, or a very large swathe of documents about the Vietnam War, photocopied, knock them out of the office, photocopied them, and then basically distributed them to the press, including the New York Times and the Washington Post. Richard Nixon and co. weren't too fucking happy about that and actually sued them and actually tried to prevent the newspapers from publishing this stuff and try to use the Espionage Act to say you can't publish it. History knows what happened, and they did get away with it in the end. They were allowed to publish it, but it was a tense time in the sense, obviously, the Americans have that freedom of speech amendment, which is kind of a bit inconvenient when the government tries to shut down the press from saying things they don't like.
Yeah.
So, this film stars, the first time ever, Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks, who are arguably the two greatest actors of their generation.
Yep.
Which is sort of a prelude to something we'll talk about a little earlier, later.
Well, I think probably between the two of them and the director, Steven Spielberg, just getting the two lead actors and the director together, you probably won't have more golden statues in a room. I don't think there's any other combination of that of two actors and a director that would potentially get that.
Well, so between the actors, they've got five. Spielberg's what, one, two? I mean, you reckon he's one. I reckon he's one. He won two, I reckon. Well, he only got one for Saving Private Ryan. Three.
As producer as well?
Well, let's see. According to IMDb, he has three Oscars.
Okay.
So he may have won two for one. So he's won a winner for Best Picture for Schindler's List, Best Director for Schindler's List, and Best Director for Saving Private Ryan.
Okay, he's been nominated a hell of a lot.
A shit ton. So there you've got eight Oscars between the three of them. Yeah. So this is a Spielberg directed this. So he's probably the only person who could probably have the kind of directorial clout also to get this made on very short notice, as I understand it.
Yeah.
And get that kind of talent on screen, as I think when Spielberg calls, anybody picks up the phone. Yes. Of course, Hanks and Spielberg go back way back, and they work together a heap. Yeah. In amongst this amazing cast is also Bob Odenkirk, who may be familiar from Saul Goodman, of course, Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad.
Sarah Paulson.
Bradley Whitford from The West Wing, looking very fucking old. Mm-hmm. Bruce Greenwood's amazing as Robert McNamara. Matthew Reese as Daniel Ellsberg. Matthew Reese, probably best known for The Americans, which is one of my favorite shows.
Oh, yeah.
Alison Brie in here from television. Meth Damon, aka Jesse Plemons.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about Meth Damon recently on the show.
Yep.
So it's an incredible cast, and it's about newspapers, which is kind of a sexy thing to make a movie about. Hollywood kind of likes that. And it's also very, very topical, considering just last week the current president gave out his fake news awards, or he tried to anyway. we are in the sense that, like, it's a story from the early 70s. It's repeating itself now. We have a president who is trying to, in his own way, restrict how the press reports things, but not using the courts yet. So it's incredibly well made. It's well paced. It's thoroughly entertaining. It kind of has a vibe of, if anybody remembers, All the President's Men.
I was going to say, how does it kind of stack up? Because it sounds like kind of a very similar kind of idea of a film, the press versus the president.
It's less, I mean, whereas I guess that film is more about the fight or the struggle that those journalists undergo to try and get sources and prove the story is real and get to the bottom of what's really going on.
So it's more on the investigation.
That's the end. It's about the investigation and getting to a point where the editor says, you've got it, we can publish this. Whereas this film's more about, they know what happened at the start because they've got the papers.
Got it. Yeah.
So they know what the story is. This question is, A, can we publish it? B, should we publish it? And, you know, that kind of thing. There are a number of different threads going on here in the sense that, you know, is this a responsible thing for a newspaper to do? Is it the, you know, are you putting, in this case, it's the Vietnam War, are you putting soldiers' lives at risk by publishing this stuff? We've got the whole thread of Meryl Streep playing Kay Graham. That was Catherine, but I think it's Kay. She's the first female newspaper publisher. She sort of inherited the newspaper from her husband who committed suicide. Okay. So she's sort of living in his shadow, and they've just made the paper go public.
Okay.
So a share offering. Mm. So, you know, she's got this sort of, she's also being pushed around and bullied a little bit. Mm. She's a fairly, what's the word, timid figure to start with.
Okay.
And we have pit bankers and sort of male figures in her life trying to push her around. So there is definitely an angle on this about her being a woman and the experience of being the only woman in that position in a man's world. And,
yeah.
you know, what is her legacy to other women as a result of that? At the same time, we've got the courts coming in going, well, you might go to jail for this.
Yeah.
They've also got the ever-present threat of the fact that Nixon was a cunt and, you know, was not the kind of person who would have necessarily play by the rules. So if you do this, you piss him off, you are now incurring the wrath of the US president.
Yeah.
So there's all sorts of stuff going on in this film, and I feel like it handled it really quite nicely.
Okay.
That said, if you stopped this film and then had a double bill for President's Man, it would be a thing of beauty. Because this film slid very, very nicely.
Okay.
Right into...
Great partners.
So it would actually be... It would literally, you could press play at the end of this film for on...
Yeah, I understand that Spielberg purposefully tailored the end to just hand and glove into the beginning of All the President's Man, so...
It's a wonderful, wonderful film. That said, though, it is Oscar bait.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think I criticised Hidden Figures last year for this.
I
liked that, but like, at the same time, you're like, oh, you are pumping for Oscars so hard.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, it's just trying, it's the goody two-shoes at school who does everything perfectly, you know, sucks up to the teacher in the morning, and you're like, you prick, you're so good, aren't you? You just think you're the best. Just because you happen to be good at everything and do everything right. You know, that's this film. It's the goody two-shoes. It's so nice and wonderful.
Yeah.
And some might criticise it for being a little preachy because I guess I'm not entirely sure of Spielberg's politics. So I would suggest he's on a Democratic side and not a Trump fan.
Yeah.
But I think it wears its politics on its sleeve. Maybe a smidge more than it might like. It's only got a 7.5 on IMDb. I would suggest that's probably why. It's slightly lower than it might be. Because it's just the people on the Trump side of politics may find it propagandary.
Oh, okay. All right. So, okay.
I mean, it's impossible to see this film in this climate about the government trying to shut down free speech and not... It's a very political thing. It's a very political thing to talk about. But anyway, I would recommend getting out and seeing it. It's playing in Australia now for the last couple of weeks. It's not playing in many, not playing much.
Mm-hmm.
So I would get out and see it while you can, because I would suggest it's probably not going to be in cinemas terribly long.
Okay. Let's make a note of the time there. Anything else you want to talk about, or shall I...
Move on. I have spoken enough.
Okay. So, I today got to check out Hail Caesar. So, this is the Coen brothers, and they have been riding high for quite a while after, like, No Country for Old Men, and... hang on, I'm completely blanking, so I'm just going to check out their IMDb.
Before that, you go back to things like Burn After Reading.
Yes, A Serious Man, Inside Llewellyn Davies, obviously Fargo, but...
They're kind of... If Spielberg is the goody two-shoes of Hollywood, the Coen brothers are the cool kids in leather jackets at the back of a classroom who smoke behind the shelter sheds.
Absolutely right. And Hail Caesar is a bizarre love letter to the golden age of cinema, at the same time as trying to make a pertinent message right now, whilst at the same time I was talking to you beforehand, it feels overbaked and undercooked. It's got the quirky, zany elements that the Coen brothers are kind of renowned for, especially in their earlier work, going up to The Ladykillers with Tom Hanks. It's got that beautiful sheen of Golden Age cinema, and 99% of the stuff that they shoot is beautiful to look at. The actors that they have involved are all very good, and they embody their characters. This is kind of a return to what George Clooney refers to as his idiot characters, as Baird Whitlock, sorry. He's kind of the golden goose of Josh Brolin's Eddie Mannix's Capitol Studios, but there's some sort of controversy in the past that they're constantly trying to kind of keep down. Eddie Maddox is being courted to take on an executive position at Lockheed. Meanwhile, George Clooney's character gets hijacked by a group of communist writers. whilst that's happening, we've got Alden Ehrenreich, who's going to be Han Solo in the Han Solo movie. He is a very good singer and limited voice acting work action man. He's done a lot of sort of like westerns and things like that, but he gets pulled in to another movie where he has to be far more eloquent. And anyone who's seen the trailers, there's a scene between him and Ralph Fiennes, and he's talking. Ralph Fiennes is trying to direct him to say, "We're too simple," and Alden can't say. He's got too much of a slur of the old Western kind of thing, and it's like "we're simple." It's really funny, and each scene is really funny, well acted, but it doesn't work together. There's also a kind of side plot with Scarlett Johansson's character. She's single after two studio arranged marriages. She's pregnant. She's got this image that they're kind of pushing in Hollywood and in America of her being innocent and sweet. So the idea of her being a single mother giving birth to someone when she's out of wedlock is terrible. So they arrange for her to give up the baby for adoption to a brief cameo by Jonah Hill. But at the meeting, they kind of hit it off and she ends up marrying him, and it's kind of a mute problem. So it's kind of, we didn't really need that in there anyway. That's just to add a little bit of extra sauce to it. The main element is, how does Eddie Maddox deal with all the shit with this Lockheed easier life just there being offered to him on a plate? You've also got a extended cameo by Channing Tatum as Bert Gurney, who I'm pretty sure is a sleeper agent for the Russians, because he gets picked up by a Russian sub in Malibu.
Of course.
And he's kind of the ringleader of all the communist writers who were the ones who kidnapped George Clooney's character. So it's a hodgepodge mess, but it's charming. It is not worth the price of admission, but it's on Netflix, so as you're already paying for it, why not check it out?
I would like to, and I'm just going to, we don't have to talk about this now, but I just like to posit a thought. It's a plant a seed.
Okay.
The Coen brothers, for all their kudos and all their sort of cool factor,
mm-hmm.
and their reputation, have not done a decent film. A genuinely successful, good film. They have not done a great film for over 10 years. For now, 10 years plus.
Where does that burn? Are you talking
Burn? I don't think after Burn After Reading they've done anything worth seeing.
I didn't see A Serious Man. I did watch True Grit. Fine, but nothing special. So yeah, I'd agree with you on that one.
I didn't like
Burn After Reading was awesome. Brad Pitt's character in particular was
great. I think it's now No Country, and I would even then say I think it may be a great film. I don't know about everybody else.
No, it's a bit of a sleeper for them. No Country for Old Men.
Man, is the last masterpiece they've done. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4 their last four projects have been a bit meh.
Yeah.
So
or they've been very tailored for either Hollywood, the people in Hollywood, like this movie, or very much fans of the Coen brothers. It's fine.
And they're doing a spin-off of the Big Lebowski, or they wrote it anyway. That's it. I still love them, but you know.
Yeah, agreed. The other thing I watched, which kind of blew my socks off, is the Netflix original animated version of a TV series, Godzilla. Now the animation is fucking incredible. It is stunningly good. I generally am not a fan of 3D generated animation, especially in the manga style, in the anime style. This, however, holy crap, it is high quality. And this is a very refreshing take on Godzilla, because it's set in the future.
Is this made in Japan, or
I believe so.
Is it in Japanese?
It just automatically sets to English, and it has got a good dub.
Okay.
I wouldn't be surprised if they spent a very good amount of time and on getting the dub right, because kind of Godzilla is a known brand that Netflix are really doing a big push on anime content. This is a good way of kind of bridging that gap for Western audiences. But so to set the scene, you get some backstory on Earth developing, growing, and then suddenly these giant monsters start coming around, and then the king of destruction, Godzilla, appears, and he keeps on just destroying stuff. He's got his atomic breath, he's got an electromagnetic shield, and things like that. And during all this, two alien races come in and try to help, but they end up having to abandon Earth. And in the evacuation, Godzilla, as well as some of the other monsters, just end up taking out most of the ship. And there's like maybe 500,000 people floating through space trying to find another habitable planet because they can't go back. The series then properly opens with a young captain as he has hijacked a dropship that is filled with old people who were told to go down to the planet and try and colonize. But the captain, he knows that the planet is not colonizable. They're just getting rid of the excess people because their resources are running out. So they're getting rid of all the old and the infirm. He gets subdued. The ship gets taken, starts going down. And in his cell, he sees out and he sees the ship explode. And there's a kind of suggestion that maybe it was sabotage. They never intended for the people to make it to the planet. But that's kind of put to the sideline because one of the alien races is a very religious-based group trying to indoctrinate mankind into the ways of their planet, and very not entirely Christian, but a lot of Christian tones to it. Not as heavily influenced as something like Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, per se, but you've got a little bit of element of that, and they're trying to push that on. They are trying to use the captain and his kind of mutiny element to encourage mankind to go back to Earth. And long story short, they do go back. The time period that they've been away, they think, oh, it's going to be 1,000 years. They get back, they do some analysis of the soil and things, and they realize, whoa, it's for closer to 10,000 years. And then they get the final resources, and it's 19,000 years. And the planet Earth is entirely fucking different. And it's essentially the animals have all evolved, and they find the signature of Godzilla. He's still fucking alive. And so they get this captain who's in the brig. He's been spending all his fucking time coming up with this manifesto on how to defeat Godzilla. And it seems practical. Goes through, they try and do it. They manage to fucking kill Godzilla. They're celebrating, they're like, excellent, we're nowhere near started, we need to get back up to the main ship because we lost fucking hundreds and hundreds of people. We need to regroup. And then a fucking mountain just explodes, and there's the real Godzilla, and he's fucking huge, and he wrecks shit. That's for the end of part one. And they're like, fuck, that is good. That is really good. It's amazing animation, amazing voice work. It's a really cool take on the story. Fucking awesome. And that's on Netflix, so watch it. Watch it, watch it, watch it.
There you go, big endorsement. I'm curious to see how that leads into the film coming in next year, of course. We've got the next Godzilla film coming next year with Millie Bobby Brown starring, of course, from Stranger Things.
Yes, we do.
Godzilla, King of Monsters.
That's right. I wonder that. I think that's still going to be part of the same universe.
Yes, according to the internet, it is.
Kong Skull Island is also in there.
It's the next chapter in Warner Brothers and Legendary Pictures' cinematic MonsterVerse, an epic action adventure that pits Godzilla against some of the most popular monsters in pop culture history.
Yeah. So
that will be interesting to see. It's being directed by the guy who wrote Superman Returns. Yay! Michael Doughty. And again, if that's your thing.
Yeah, but anyway, the other thing that I got around to doing, because I said I would, I went back and watched San Junipero.
And you didn't like it.
I did not like it. And it wasn't that It just wasn't my taste. I thought it was bad. I thought it was badly done. I'll tell you why. It was boring. And there was not a single element of it that made me uncomfortable or creepy. There wasn't any kind of twist to it. And the ending was happy when I don't think it should have been. I was expecting throughout the credits for when it's showing kind of the mainframe farm kind of thing, I was expecting there to be a power cut, poof, and they lose all that data. That's kind of what I was hoping for, and I would, if that had happened, I was like, fuck, that's cool. But they didn't go there.
Mm.
And I was very disappointed with that. In my opinion, the stuff in season one, the stuff that I've watched in season two, it was much more grim and much more affecting than this. This was very, very much more popcorn-y and pedestrian.
See, last week you criticized it for being grim.
Yeah.
And this week it's not grim enough.
Yeah. Because the setting of USS Callister, it just didn't work. It didn't work as a grim thing. They had these very different tones that just didn't gel for me. Mm-hmm. I can understand where it went, the production value and their direction.
Yeah, no, I get that. But like you said last week, it was grim and you didn't like it because it was grim.
Yeah.
And this is why I recommend, this is why I think San Junipero is so effective and why it has an 8.8 on IMDb, is that you go in, you're certainly right, but the first two seasons were bleak as fuck. And that's part of, we sort of established last week, that's kind of a difference between you and me. I really enjoy that in my TV.
Yeah.
But what I found so effective about this is there's a little, the twist is that it's not. That is the twist, in the sense that if you sort of followed the show, chronologically, as they were episode 1, 2, 3, and 4 in this season, the episode before it, I think, and I'll be happy to be corrected, is Shut Up and Dance.
Okay.
Which is, I'll just double check that, but it's one of the most fucked up episodes in the show's history, in my opinion. And certainly one of those ones you go, oh, fuck, I didn't see that coming. Mm. So, and then to sort of swerve into this, where you get something set up and you're like, okay, I can see what's happening here. And then you, as per the show's normal course, you're expecting to be slapped upside the head at some point.
Yeah.
It never did. And it had that really quite beautiful ending between the two of them, but they've decided to actually, you know, put aside whatever, without spoiling it for anybody who hasn't seen it, some of their personal hang-ups or personal decisions to decide to spend eternity forever. That's the that's the
See,
twist.
What I think they should have done is because of is it Kelly? Yeah, Kelly. The reason why she takes so long to get around to her decision is because of what her husband was saying about what happens next and everything like that. I would have been really happy to have them be together at the end. But then the post-credit thing where they're just cutting to the chips and all that stuff.
Mm.
I would have fucking loved it if that had just been wiped out, because that would have just put cemented in. There's no security and there's no certainty in what happens next for that. And there's still no security if you rely on technology. There's still no guarantee. So you're fucked either way. They still would have had their happy ending, but not really. I just think that would have been a much more impacting finish to an episode of something that hangs its hat on being bleak, taking you to that dark place. And I think it would have been a much better thing, because everyone has... This is the age of backing up on into the cloud and stuff like that. Everyone's had that situation where they go, why hasn't that fucking backed up? And how frustrating and annoying that is to have that looming over you. That would have been better. And it just didn't work. I didn't think that the actors were particularly engaging either. I thought they were fine, but there was nothing special about it. Whereas in all of the other episodes, the actors have always really brought an impressive game.
I think the upshot, or I guess the conclusion, is clear that this show is never going to make you happy.
No, it's
because this
it's
is as close to a masterpiece or universal acclaim as you'll ever get for a show. And if this didn't do it for you, and the bleakness didn't do it for you, nothing is going to do it for you.
No. I still think that the best that the show has been was either the one with the grain or the very first episode.
The National Anthem.
Yeah, National Anthem. Yeah.
I would just like to say, just to put George's opinion aside, if you... Well, I mean, look, I still bump into people today, other than you, who tell me, I don't like it. Like, somebody told me they watched the first episode and they thought it was disgusting. I'm like, yeah, that's the fucking point.
Yeah.
Or they just, like, I thought it was boring, and I'm like, that I can't possibly imagine how that's possible, but okay. Other than to say, if you do like this show, I caught the episode this week, after we recorded last week, I came home, and I'm like,
Johnson, man.
Well, we're talking last week, and I was looking at the IMDb ratings, and so episode one of this season, Eustace Callister, which you didn't care for, 8.4, episode two and three, I kind of found them a bit, okay, 7.4, 7.3, but then episode four, Hang the DJ, 8.9.
And so, I've heard a lot of people talking about this one.
8.9, and so I'm like, I think I need to see this episode. And this is this season's San Junipero.
Okay.
Now, you didn't like San Junipero, you didn't like most of the other stuff, you're probably not going to like Hang the DJ. So, I were not going to recommend it to you, because like, it's obviously painful to make you watch stuff you don't like. I tried Fringe last year.
Yeah.
I thought it was silly.
Yeah.
You love it.
That's fine.
But
the big thing about San Junipero for me is it was the first one that I've watched that I just didn't like. I didn't think it was good. Everything else, I didn't like it because it's just not what I like to consume.
Mm.
But I can appreciate everything that it was going for. I just didn't think
that San Junipero. And that's unusual. But it's I was just going to say that if you are a fan, hang in there for this season and do check out Hang the DJ. It's wonderful television, and if you liked San Junipero, you probably will like it. If you didn't like San Junipero, I would put money on you probably not liking it. So, but it's, look, there's only more two more seasons, there's two more episodes this season, so I'm like, oh, I'm four down. Hang on to them for, you know, it's like break glass in case of emergency.
It's going to be a while before your next fix, man.
Well, the next one's got a 6.8 on IMDb, which I think is about as low as I've seen one of these episodes. So I'm like, do I, you mean, you're going to get there eventually, don't you?
Yeah. well, that, I think, should we go into our topic of conversation, or do you want to have a quick break?
I'm good if you are.
I might have a quick break because I need to pee. Back soon. And we're back. And we're going to be talking about the greatest actors of all time. Because a thread came up on Facebook from indie100.com. They named Tom Hanks as the greatest actor of all time. I'm going to quickly run down the list of, I think it's like top 10. And then we're going to talk a little bit about our personal choices and if we agree with this list. So number one is Tom Hanks. Number two, Betty Davis. Number three, Marlon Brando. Four, James Stewart. Number five, Katharine Hepburn. Number six, Robert De Niro. Number seven, Jack Nicholson. Number eight, Morgan Freeman. Number nine, Anthony Hopkins. Number 10, Dustin Hoffman. What do you think of that list, Trav?
It's solid. I've been having a think about it today after we decided to do it on the show. It's difficult in some parts. Some of the difficulties I faced were people like Betty Davis or Marlon Brando. I'm just not as across their work as a film fan should be.
Agree.
In terms of Brando, we were talking before we went on the air. I think I can remember seeing four Brando films.
Mm-hmm.
Apocalypse Now and Godfather, which were quite good. Obviously, Godfather's an amazing film, but I feel like he's got a fairly smallish role in it all up.
Yeah.
As iconic as it is. But also, the next two I remember are The Island of Dr. Moreau and The Score.
Yeah.
Which are terrible, terrible films, and I should, you know, like, not mention them. But I don't remember seeing any...
Don't say them three times, they may come back.
I don't remember seeing any Betty Davis films. I've seen very few Audrey Hepburn films, if any. So...
And just looking back on Betty Davis' kind of career, and I think I have watched All About Eve, the 1950s movie, but I'm just looking back and not recognizing many of these at all.
So I mean, she may be a very, very fine actress. I certainly would never begrudge, you know, obviously someone such a legend of Hollywood.
I guess I should say this collection was voted by 1.1 million voters in a ranker poll. So I don't know if ranker polls are just randomly, like, publicly open or anything like that. But
well, it sounds fairly reasonable. I mean, from what you use through legend alone, you know, these people have reputations of being very fine actors. I mean, the older crowd people, you know, they're probably in their 60s plus now, would probably remember Bette Davis.
Yeah, I guess there must be something to it, the fact that neither of us are familiar with her work, but we both know who
she's a style icon. Yeah. I mean, she's two Oscar wins. I mean, not many, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the first one was for Best Actress in 1939.
Damn.
So, we're going back a long way with someone like Bette Davis. So, it's hard to ask for me to say she should be on my list because I just don't know enough about her.
Yeah.
Audrey Hepburn, I probably should know more about her. I think I've seen one or two of her films. So, it's kind of difficult to make a call on that. So, we're always probably going to focus on more. Well, I decided I think it's only reasonable, despite the fact I believe those stories that say Brando was the greatest actor who ever lived. I just can't say personally, so I'm going to focus more on people I'm familiar with.
Agreed.
I feel like the other one, and I talked to you about this a second ago as well, was how do you rank somebody with a really solid, good career, where of doing very, very few sort of like bad films, against, say, someone like Brando, who
scaled extraordinary.
I mean, like, extraordinary roles, but then ended up with films like Dr. Moreau. Yeah. Or, you know, if you want to talk Al Pacino, amazing films like the Godfather films, but then also Jack and Jill and Gilly and stuff like that. Yeah. So, how do you balance those out?
Yeah.
And it's a difficult thing. And I guess in the end, you kind of got to go with what your instinct says.
Yeah. So, we're going to kind of list off a few of our greatest actors of all time. I'm not really going to put in any particular order, but this is just kind of not our personal favourites, just the ones that have kind of...
That's a keen thing to make here, is these people, while I probably would say if the four I've got written down on a piece of paper in front of me I quite like, they were not necessarily there because, oh, I have to see the film that they're in.
Yeah.
Other actors I quite like. So let's say, I'm just going to say straight off, Hanks is not on my list. Leo DiCaprio would not be on my list. I think they're both fine actors who I like quite a bit.
Yeah.
I have a lot of trouble with buying them in certain roles. I've said it before, I think Leo DiCaprio plays Leo DiCaprio in pretty much every role he's ever in, except probably any time, and again, Tarantino's Django Unchained is the first time I've seen him really step outside.
Calvin Candy, fucking amazing role.
And of course, he's also now just been cast in the new Tarantino film that's set in the Manson, against the backdrop of the Manson family.
Yeah,
that will be, and people are saying, well, I hope he plays Manson. I'm like, well, that could be interesting. That
could be very interesting.
I don't think he will.
Nah. but, okay, so first name you want to throw out.
And this is a controversial, I'm just going to throw us right out there into the controversy, Russell Crowe.
I don't think that's too controversial.
I told someone today and they're like, really?
I don't think that's too controversial. I mean, just think of the work that he's done. He just went stratospheric after Gladiator. He made Hollywood history. He made himself known in Hollywood for L.A. Confidential, where it's fucking awesome. Romper Stomper, that we talked about last week, is holy shit good. And then he's got, like, he was fucking amazing as Jor-El in Man of Steel.
I thought he was a solid, really good point. Actually, one of the things I really liked about that. But he had a really hot streak there for a while, starting in Australia with films like The Some of Us. Before that, a couple of years, we had Romper Stomper. There was a film called The Efficiency Expert he had a small role in, which was released here in Australia as Spotswood. And then we move into his Hollywood stuff. Let's not mention Virtuosity.
I kind of like that as a really trashy movie.
But then you write L.A. Confidential in 97, through to The Insider in 99, which he was Academy Award nominated for that.
Yes.
Then we had Gladiator, A Beautiful Mind, Master and Commander. That's a pretty good one. I mean, Master and Commander, I think, is underrated.
I don't like it, but I'm just not a fan of that kind of film. But
I feel like he was very good in it.
He was really good in Nice Guys as well.
He was fantastic in Nice Guys, which is a nice change. I think he's still got it.
Yeah.
I don't know whether he's going down the Nicolas Cage route and he just says yes to anything, or
I don't think he's there, but I think he's just kind of at a point where he's like, I've kind of proven myself. I just want to do things that really engage with me now.
Stuff he wants now. It's fine, I guess, if you don't need the money. I mean, but look, you know, even films like 310 to Yuma, which is in 2007, I thought he was pretty good in that too.
I
think he's still capable of it. I feel like he is in that category of, he has scaled insane heights,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion. I've said it regular times in the show and on G&T.
Yeah.
I hate A Beautiful Mind as a film.
Yeah, I think it's pretty trash.
And having read the book,
mm-hmm.
it's a fascinating story which Ron Howard turned into a soap opera.
Yeah.
But, my God, is he good in that film.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason he didn't win back-to-back Oscars is because he was a tool at the time and bashed someone with a telephone. but so he's
my, Australian.
He is. He's from fucking New Zealand. He's not actually a citizen.
Doesn't he own part of... like one of the...
He did. I think he still does. But he's actually been denied citizenship a number of times. so he's actually not an Australian citizen, despite the fact anyone says, Aussie Russell. So,
well, New Zealand isn't really its own country.
It's really... It's basically East New South Wales. Oh, do we have any Kiwi listeners?
No, we don't.
Okay. So that's my first choice.
Okay. Nice. I like it. My first choice? Glenn Close.
It's an interesting choice. I don't know a lot of her work, apart from that zombie film we saw recently.
As in...
The Girl with All the Gifts.
Yes, Girl with All the Gifts, yeah. So, I really like her for her fucking range. Girl with All the Gifts, she was awesome in it. I thought she really did something quite unique with... Granted, a limited role that she had, but it worked very well.
She was very androgynous.
Yeah, and she's done that quite a few times. Like, she played a pirate in Hook for Steven Spielberg, just as a cameo. And like, you can kind of see that it's her, just in the eyes, but she's... teaser for one of my other ones is going to be Tilda Swinton, where...
Why did I fucking forget her?
They both can play on that gender-neutral line really quite successfully. Fatal Attraction was maybe the first time that I really got to watch any Glenn Close in a point of analytical phase in my brain, and it's not a good film, but fuck, is she raw in it. She's brutal. Really just can't help but be impressed by what she did with that role. Holy shit, she was in Warcraft
voice, wasn't it?
Yeah, wow. I did not know that. She's done the more kind of blockbustery stuff of, like, she was Nova Prime in Guardians of the Galaxy. She was solid in that. She has, yes, Albert Nobbs. That was the name of the movie that I was trying to remember.
He basically played a man in that film. Yeah. A woman playing a man.
Yeah. And it was, she was just fucking incredible. Let's just have a look and see. She's never won an Oscar.
Nominated
six times, but it sounds nuts. It feels like Meryl Streep has just been stealing her thunder every time. And she was fucking brilliant as Cruella de Vil in 101 Dalmatians. Loved it.
Good choice.
Really like Glenn.
While we're talking, you just mentioned her. I'm going to go straight in with Meryl Streep. My trump card. It didn't hurt that I saw her today in what will, I'm sure, be another Oscar-nominated role.
Mm-hmm.
So she's been nominated a shit ton of times. I think she holds the record. I think three is the record for an actress. So she won for Sophie's Choice in 82,
mm-hmm.
Kramer versus Kramer, and then Iron Lady in 2011. You're Swalking, and then she goes, Jesus Christ, she was nominated for Out of Africa, Julie and Julia.
Yes.
We could keep going.
Yeah.
Speaking about range, this is an actor with insane range, and this is why I feel like a differentiator from someone like DiCaprio, who has, you know, does a lot of very good films. Streep probably the same, but I completely buy her when she gets into a role. So if you get her into a role,
disappears.
So if you see it, if you've seen Sophie's Choice, which she 82. You completely buy her as a survivor, a Jewish survivor of a Holocaust. You see her in a film like A Cry in the Night, or I think, which was released as Evil Angels in Australia, which was the Lindy Chamberlain story. She does a very reasonable Australian accent. We do take the piss out of it a little bit here. A dungo took my Barbie. She did it. It was a pretty reasonable Hollywood Australian accent. And again, you completely buy her as Lindy Chamberlain, as someone who's seen a lot of that person, you know, in the news and stuff, you go, oh, I get that. Into something where she played Thatcher, really completely occupied that role. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an obvious choice, but, you know, and then you go see if it's something like, something completely different from playing a real person to The Devil Wears Prada, which yep. he plays an exaggerated version of Anna Wintour, the fashionista, but playing Miranda Priestly. I mean, that's almost a iconic role now, and it's, you know, it's a silly little comedy, and, you know, she can do anything. And today, I was just watching her very closely today, because I figured she might be, she might come up. And I'm like, just a little, you know, mannerisms and stuff. But she was playing an older, sort of matronly, old-moneyed sort of woman who's in, potentially over her head a little bit and swimming like crazy.
Yeah.
Just seeing the little facial tweaks here and there, and the way she used her hands, that. And she's of a small quaver of a voice when she'd start talking, and you'd be like, wow, I am 100% on board with you. I mean, it's not the most challenging role she's probably ever played, but like, I was like, no, you've absolutely got this right. It was just, she's next level.
Yeah.
In fact, I would say if I was to rate one of the greatest actor on earth living, I think it would probably be Meryl Streep.
It's hard to argue with that. There are very few that could challenge that, I think. So my next one, mentioned her already, Tilda Swinton.
This is a fine, fine choice. I can't believe I didn't think of Tilda.
Yeah, I mean, she was the ancient one in Doctor Strange, which is fucking weird. She was phenomenal in We Need to Talk About Kevin.
Oh, she was she?
So good in her cameo in the Grand Budapest Hotel. She's fucking unrecognizable in Snowpiercer.
Oh, I'm sorry, you keep saying, oh my god, it's so good.
She just disappears into the roles.
And then going back to probably the one that really took her to the next level was her role in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yeah, I think that kind of got her the...
She took it to she was almost an indie star before then. She became a major movie star. Because I think she was nominated for an Academy Award for that.
I think she was, actually, yeah.
She just won an Oscar, so, for Michael Clayton.
Yeah.
No, I mean, she wasn't nominated.
No?
But okay. She should have been.
But seriously, she's another one. Oh, fuck, she was in Constantine as well. She was one of the best fucking parts of that movie, which wasn't very good.
No, it wasn't.
it wasn't. Well, it was fine, it just wasn't at all anything like Constantine, the graphic novels, but never mind. I think everything that you said about Meryl Streep can fairly easily be translated into Tilda. I think she's someone who is constantly right there as, when you see her name, you think, yep, I'm going to see something new.
Quality.
Yeah, I'm going to see something new.
I think I've talked about it in a podcast before, but if you're a fan of Tilda Swinton and you have not seen the film Julia... 2008, a woman tries to extort money using a young boy as bait. Like, you can see her, if you've seen her play, as you sort of say, the ancient one, you've seen her play whatever the fuck it was she was supposed to be in Snowpiercer. And you see her, she'll now see her play basically an absolute scumbag criminal.
Yeah. What are you doing,
Riley?
Oh, I think he's rubbing his
back.
Poor Riley, the producer, has got a bit of a sore spot on his bum, so he's probably.
Apologies for the interruption to normal. Now we return to normal broadcasting.
Yeah, after last week's episode where I was being clawed to shit.
By a cat. Yeah, so it's one thing. It's not one thing. It's another.
So I think she is definitely worthy of being part of the conversation for on the list of greatest actors of all time.
Absolutely. I'm going to go with another one who's scaled great heights, but maybe you might go, if you were a millennial, you might go, really? That is Robert De Niro.
I think it's fine, yeah. I don't think it's fair to kind of say, oh, well, what he's done now kind of diminishes what he's done before.
I've sort of decided in this list that sort of, well, I actually thought to myself earlier today, if I had time, I think a scientific approach would be the way to go here. Mm-hmm. I could actually go through a list of all the films of theirs I've seen, assign them a number, and then come out with a median score, but that would take far more time than I had. That's one for you at work next week, maybe. So, but De Niro, I felt like if, you know, the stuff that he's done that is good, should, you know, we'll just ignore the shit that, like, Bad Grandpa or whatever the fuck it is he's done lately.
Yeah.
With Johnny Knoxville and stuff like that. But we go back to just, films like Raging Bull, Goodfellas, he was in The Godfather.
Godfather, too.
The, Taxi Driver, Casino, you know, what was the Scorsese film, Cape Fear?
Holy shit.
You know what I mean? It was a reboot, terrifying. It was a remake, but he was amazing, and he sort terrifying. Of made it. Well, it was already very famous. He sort of made it his own, and I'm probably forgetting. Even the Analyze This films, where he sort of showed, you know what, he can actually do comedy.
He can when it's under the control of someone who knows how to do comedy.
And it was nothing to write home about, but it was fine. I mean, he even did Jackie Brown with Tarantino, and it was reasonable.
Yeah, he was funny in it.
Sleepers, you know, it's it just heat. So this is a guy who for a long time was kicking goal after goal after goal, and he's taking it easy now, and he's an anti-vaxxer, and he makes weird anti-Trump videos and stuff. So, you know, he's gone left field. So after his previous successes, but I mean, he has two Oscars. Mm-hmm. So again, he's in the same sort of class as someone like Hanks for Godfather and Raging Bull. He was nominated for Cape Fear, for Deer Hunter.
Oh my God!
So I mean, it's a challenging film, but it's quality.
Yeah.
So, you know, once upon a time, having the name De Niro on your film poster was the Nintendo gold badge of quality.
Be assured.
So I feel like if you were looking to delve into someone's back catalogue, he's got a lot of gold in there.
If you're going to mention Robert De Niro, you've got to kind of mention his contemporary Al Pacino. I mean,
it was a tough call between the two of them for me.
Started, his first movie was 1969, and it was just NYPD. And then 72, Michael Corleone. I mean, wow. And I think you've got to look at his character development across the entire Godfather trilogy, because it is incredible. He shows so much range just in that trilogy of movies on its own. It's incredible. And then he did, like, Serpico. I don't think it's a very good film, but he is really good in it. You've mentioned it already. Heat is fucking amazing, and...
Well, Dog Day Afternoon's a very famous one in there as well. Scarface is iconic.
Yeah, I just get into Scarface. What else? Holy shit! Yes, of course he was in Dick Tracy!
Now, that's not something you'd want to advertise.
But stylistically, I fucking love that movie. It's kind of like a precursor to Sin City and 300. And it's like, it's style over substance, but he acts through his makeup like so many of the great makeup artists, like Doug Jones, who's in Star Trek. He's always fantastic at that. Ron Perlman is awesome when he does it for Hellboy. Yeah, so, I mean, stuff like Scent of a Woman, no. That was a token Oscar because he should have won one previously. Carlito's Way, I like, but Donnie Brasco,
just when I was out, they pull me back in.
Yeah, even Devil's Advocate.
I
think that's quite a good one, but his last really great movie, Insomnia.
Yeah.
He was good in Simone, but nah.
It's not a great film,
Yeah,
though.
It's not a great film. But yeah, fucking Insomnia, man. It's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Brilliant performance. He shows serious weakness when this is a guy who is infamous for going, "What do we got?" and just screaming and shouting and being so powerful all the time, and just seeing him being so broken and tired. It was awesome.
God, he's got another film coming out with De Niro. It'll be three, I think.
Oh, God. No. No more. No more, please.
Quit while you're ahead, guys.
Yeah.
Let me go in together in Righteous Kill, if I'm not mistaken, which I've never seen.
It's not good for either of them. And then, didn't they do a boxing one or something?
No, that was Stallone. That was basically Raging Bull versus Rocky.
Rocky.
but it was sort of like the knockoff version because they didn't actually have either. They weren't playing Jake LaMotta and Rocky Balboa.
They didn't. Neither of them had the rights for those characters at that time.
So, but because it was like Jake LaMotta was a real character and Rocky was a fictional character.
Shut up.
Hey, Alien versus Predator happened, so you know. And we've got King Kong versus Godzilla, so I guess
That's coming. That's coming. What's your next one?
My last one on the list here was Dustin Hoffman.
Ah, yeah.
So I think he was on the original list from Indy 100.
Yes, he was.
Again, this guy's got an incredible career spanning a long time. Let's ignore the more recent allegations against him. He's one of many people who said allegations made against him recently.
I didn't hear about those ones.
I could be mistaken. I thought I heard about that. But you go through to things like Marathon Man, The Graduate, All the President's Men again, Rain Man. He's pretty, and then you know it's a bit preachy, Oscar-baity,
but it's still he's very good.
Tootsie, I think he might have. Would he win an Oscar for Tootsie?
I think he did.
I don't like it personally. Again, I feel like that's his scent of a woman.
Yeah.
And he did not. He won it for Kramer versus Kramer, which was also a Meryl Streep film. He's fantastic in that. We Wag the Dog, we reviewed that on the G&T podcast in our political film sort of, what do you call it, season. He is certainly a fantastic range as an actor. Mm-hmm. He sort of made the most of his talents, I feel like, and he's had a career that sort of stretched. I mean, where does his first films go back to the late 50s, early 60s, sorry.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and he's still, I guess you might say, a movie star today in at least the Kung Fu Panda films.
He's really good as Master Shifu, and I really like him. The movie is kind of a mess, but I Heart Huckabees, he's an existential detective.
Yes, that was good.
And I really liked him, and Lily Tomlin was fucking awesome in that as well.
I actually kind of liked it. It didn't make any sense. It was a mess.
Yeah.
But I kind of liked it anyway. But yeah, you're right. So, I mean, he's kind of gone. I mean, the 2000s haven't been as kind to him as early in his career. He's kind of gone down a similar kind of path. He was also in Dick Tracy, by the way.
Yes.
So, but, he is somebody when you, again, I think he's scaled some insane heights as an actor. If you see his early work, was he Midnight Cowboy? Was that the film with him?
I'm walking here. One of the most impressive improvs of all time. My number four, Robin Williams.
You hinted at this last week, and he is, again, somebody who did some very great things.
Mm-hmm. But he's done fucking awful stuff.
Yeah.
Like RV. Awful. But
Old Dogs. Is that them?
Like De Niro, the recent does not.
I mean, my only objection with Williams is that for very, very rarely did we ever see him play anybody except Robin Williams. There were occasions, Insomnia. I think of a film where he played the guy who worked in the chemist. 1 minute, 1 hour photo.
Yes.
I thought they were the two of the films that stood out most for me. I guess maybe Good Will Hunting.
Yep.
The Fisher King.
World's Greatest Dad is actually pretty good. It's another Bobcat Goldthwait movie.
It's a dark fucking movie.
Yeah. But he's really good in it, and he's not really Robin Williams in it.
No, actually, now that I mention it, I just keep backing up in my head. Well, there was Good Will Hunting, was Dead Poets, and you know what?
He really showed, and then, of course, possibly his most iconic role, the genie in Aladdin. Fucking amazing in that, incredible work. Even The Night Listener, which was 2006, it was an interesting attempt at a more complicated sci-fi kind of mystery kind of thing. Didn't work as a movie, but he played quite an interesting character. So, yeah, I think he's worthy of at least being in the conversation. Fucking Death to Smoochie, man.
That was a weird one as well.
Really weird, but kind of
cool.
Good,
yeah.
Yeah, kind of cool. I would also think it's... It may be a bit early, and she may be weighed a little bit too much in rom-coms, but I think Sandra Bullock's really good. Because She was really fucking good in Miss Congeniality, which is a fucking popcorn movie beyond all reckoning. But then see her in Gravity, and wow! I also really like her in The Net, which was one of her earlier movies. And she's just popped up every now and then, just suddenly going, oh yeah, remember me? And then she'll go off and do fucking All About Steve or something like that, and it's like, oh no, Sandra...
Yeah, I like Sandra Bullock, but I don't
think she's more worthy of my favourite.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think she's in this. She doesn't deserve to be mentioned in this company. If I'm going to finish out, if I'm going to round out a top five, might as well round out, make it a nice top five. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go with a more current person, or a person who I feel like, and I've said before in a podcast, I think he's the person doing the best work going around today, and that is Tom Hardy. So he's only 40, and he's early in his career, but this is a guy who has under his belt films like Inception, Warrior, Mad Max Fury Road, Dunkirk just recently. He played Bane in The Dark Knight Rising.
Bronson.
I haven't seen Bronson.
Really?
No.
Oh, dude.
It just doesn't seem to appeal to me. I must see it, but Locke is the one that stands out to me as well, which nobody has seen.
You really like that.
It was just him in the car talking on the phone for 40 minutes. but I really like watching Tom Hardy. I mean, you know, he made the smart decision to steer clear of Suicide Squad.
But he did play a Romulan clone of Jean-Luc Picard.
He was early in his career, in fairness. He was in The Revenant, which everybody else likes, but I haven't brought myself to watch yet. Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Oh, that's great. Oh, see, that's another notable Gary Oldman.
Gary Oldman I thought about, and I just thought, I don't know that I've seen enough of his stuff, because I think Fifth Element, the Batman films, and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Oh, you haven't seen The Firm?
Don't think so.
That's fucking awesome. Not the Tom Cruise one. This is about this is about British football club thuggery.
So look, I think you know, he's got a way to go, and yeah, he's had some hits and misses in him. Star Trek Nemesis was, you know, 15, 16 years ago. Come on. He was in Black Hawk Down.
Yes, we
I think he's possibly the best actor doing the rounds today. I'm very interested to see what happens with Venom.
Yeah.
Because, like, it's such an odd concept to let's pull a villain out of the Spider-Man universe, which we're not making Spider-Man films at Sony anymore.
And whether they are, they're just in league with...
Yeah, they've handed the reins over, and they're going to collect their coin. But let's pull him out of that, make him a standalone, a character who not many people know, and if they do know him, he was played by Topher Grace in Spider-Man 3.
It's already an improvement.
So,
I guarantee that.
It will be, does this go down the last time they tried to pull out a villain from a comic book film and make their own standalone film, being probably Catwoman? But Tom Hardy's a much... I mean, Halle Berry was coming off an Academy Award.
Yeah.
So it's not like...
That seems to be quite a common trait. So like, win an award, have a flop. Could be good in Junior, anyone? Do you remember that guy?
Sure, sorry?
Cuba Gooding Jr.
Well, there's nothing but flops. He's in Optus commercials now.
Yeah, I know. That's like, oh.
He was good in the OJ TV show.
Yeah.
Well, this is the same director of Zombieland, which I kind of liked. 30 Minutes or Less, which I thought was okay.
Yeah.
So, not terribly encouraging. Mm. He also directed Gangster Squad.
Okay.
It's off the topic, but if anyone can pull it off, it's Tom, and maybe he's just cashing in.
Yeah, maybe, but,
maybe one day he can make a fucking Christopher Nolan film where we see his face.
We did! Inception!
Oh, true, sorry, I forgot about that one, yeah. So I was thinking of, looking at Don Kirk, he had his face covered, and going,
I think when we're talking Chris Nolan, obviously, I think it's worthwhile mentioning Christian Bale.
He was certainly in consideration.
Mm-hmm. As well as, I think you have to kind of include Robert Downey Jr. in the conversation, considering stuff like his role in Chaplin. And then he was really good in Singing Detective, which so few people saw. And that was an awesome role. Semi-quiet return for Mel Gibson as well. He did a really good job in that, though. And then... fucking iconic as Iron Man. Plus, him playing Lazarus something or other in Tropic Thunder.
Yeah, basically playing Russell Crowe.
Yeah, fucking hilarious. Brilliant.
I think RDJ is a good actor, and I think he's great as Iron Man. Again,
he plays himself a lot.
Don't think he belongs in this category of, this is the upper echelon, these are the big hitters, and I think he kind of has probably the talent to be amongst them, but I mean, I haven't seen Chaplin, so I couldn't say.
It's beautiful.
Honestly, if you ask me to name a Danny Jr. film other than a Marvel film, I could say Tropic Thunder,
mm-hmm.
Hearts and Souls.
Oh, Jesus. Okay, come on. Weird Science.
Been a lot of good seeing that, was he?
Yes, he was. He's
going back a long way.
He was one of the bullies.
Going back a long, long way. I have seen that, yes. But Bale, I think, is a worthy nominee, apart from, obviously, he was fine in the Batman films.
Mm.
I think also a film like The Mechanic, where he lost all that weight.
Yeah. I really liked his performance in The Prestige.
The Fighter was very good. The
Fighter was awesome, yeah.
He was okay in Public Enemies, which was a thoroughly poor film.
Yeah. I really, and even for a basic action movie, Equilibrium.
Yeah.
Equilibrium. Underappreciated movie. Not trying to be anything fantastic or spectacular, or it came out of in the Matrix bubble, and it's like, oh, Gun Carter. It's like, no, the dystopian world that they live in is far more interesting than Gun Carter.
But I think we're forgetting probably the key one in his early career is American Psycho.
Yes. And Shaft.
He plays a white supremacist in Shaft. We're doing another Shaft film.
Oh, fuck, really? No.
Yeah, but this one's going to... I think this is going to be, like, a continuation, like, I have a new Shaft, and Samuel Jackson will be, like... It's called... Yeah,
Son of Shaft?
It is literally called Son of Shaft.
No! This is partnering up with fucking Son of Crocodile Dundee.
Well, that just came out today, apparently, but I've heard that could be a joke. That may not be a real film.
I kind of want to watch it, though.
I read it, and it certainly has no evidence over talking, if those who were paying attention. It was a Danny McBride trailer thing that landed on the internet this morning called The Son of Dundee, which is supposedly
probably like a Funny or Die thing.
It's a lot of money in that trailer, but what I've heard, I don't know if there's any source for this, but the supposition that in this article I read was that Danny McBride is too fucking busy, and anyone who would have sank that kind of money into making another Crocodile Dundee film would not have been able to keep it that quiet.
Yeah.
So that they feel like this is some sort of viral marketing campaign leading up to the Super Bowl.
Okay.
So, fingers crossed that it's Crocodile Dundee. I've never seen Crocodile Dundee in LA, but I might as well just, please, stop, he's already dead.
No, Crocodile in LA was the second one. There's Crocodile Dundee in Las Vegas.
No, there's not.
Yes, there is.
No, there isn't.
There is. There's a thing where he goes to Las Vegas.
No.
Is this where
there's Crocodile Dundee 2, and then there's Crocodile Dundee in LA.
Is it LA?
LA. Yeah, that was the third one. There's only been three of these films.
Oh, shit. Oh, it was New York that I'm thinking. Yeah, because he goes to New York in the
first one. And then the second one, it starts in New York and it comes back to Australia.
That's right, yeah.
And I haven't actually seen the third one, but I assume much of it is set in LA, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
The second one is much maligned. It's actually pretty decent, I think. it's still formulaic, but it's not as good as the first one. But look, if someone said to me today, it'll be all right, even if it is a real movie, because it's got Danny McBride in it. He's really funny. And I was just, sorry, do I know you? Danny McBride and funny in the same sentence just seems a bit strange.
Yeah,
he's thoroughly awful in everything I've ever seen him in, except for Alien Covenant, which makes no sense.
Yeah, that's true.
Everything else was bad about that film.
Yeah, he was good, kind of. His character's intelligence was very questionable. He's like, no, we gotta go down there. I'm like, no. Don't.
No, yeah.
Don't be stupid.
But they all seem to do that in those films now. Yeah, but so that's our top five, or sort of rough, off the top of our head, sort of top five actors we sort of think might qualify to be mentioned amongst the best. According to our criteria, again, keeping in mind, we haven't seen every film ever fucking made.
No.
No one pays for us to go to the movies.
Yeah.
No one pays for us to watch films. So, you know, the David Strattons of the world, a little bit more time and money and, exactly. and experience to watch that everything that Marlon Brando has ever done. Have we forgotten somebody you think has been hard done by?
Yeah, let us know.
Do you think, you know, could you make an argument that says, you know, I don't know, Christina Loken should be mentioned amongst his luminaries?
That's
you know?
A name from... pure obscurity.
What
now.
About Natasha Henstridge? Did you see Species? you know, like, you know, on more seriously, like Anthony Hopkins was on
yes.
the list you mentioned earlier. Should he be in the conversation? I don't know. You know, Jeff Goldblum, maybe. but so, you know, you mentioned, you talk, let us know. Facebook,
yeah.
Twitter, let Donald Trump know. These guys fucking forgot Natasha Henstridge.
Of course. Cameron, man.
Of course. That goes without saying.
Yeah, that's true. He's number one, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Shall we talk about Run the Jewels?
Sure.
Yeah?
Okay. Sure. So, what did you think of it? Hip-hop is not your favorite genre of music.
No, it's not. I appreciated everything it did. I liked... it made it far more palatable, especially after Aldous Harding, where there was like, oh, fucking hell, 6 minutes? This is quite a long album, Run the Jewels, was Volume 3, I think it's called?
Correct.
Something like that.
Run the Jewels 3.
Yeah. There's like 20 tracks on there, but they're like a minute, 2 minutes long. But they're really good, and it's... The hardest thing for me to do with this genre of music is it's essentially storytelling, and I'm terrible at actually paying attention to lyrics. So I found I had to listen to it twice... the first time I was kind of driving, and then I had it just in the background at work, thinking, oh, this will be fine. And I'm like, no, I need to pay attention. And I wanted to pay attention, so I listened to it a second time, just sitting there, headphones on, and really appreciated everything it did, thought it was pretty good, thought the album was still a bit long. It felt like they were kind of repeating riffs and tunes.
Only 51 minutes long.
Yeah.
That's not long for an album.
I know that, but I feel like it might have had a bit more impact with me if it was, you know, just lost like three tracks.
I'm on the same set of track, and it's probably my problem a little bit with hip-hop as well.
Mm.
You're right, and it is something it's trying to say, especially with a group like this, who apparently, according to Wikipedia, are a hip-hop supergroup.
Okay.
Two people I've never heard of. So
that's when it's like multiple people, so like producers and artists all just banding together, right?
Well, I mean, it kind of hip hop supergroup. I mean, I don't know what you define a supergroup is. A music group whose members are previously successful as solo artists or as part of other groups or well known in other musical professions.
It's strange, I didn't hear Will Smith in that.
So I would say somewhat. Well, there are other hip hop artists outside of Will Smith. I know you'd be
shocked. Shut up. None of consequence.
In Melbourne at the moment too, Will.
That's right.
Someone saw him at tennis.
A whole bunch of bright stuff, I think.
So, I mean, to use a rock and roll example I'm familiar with, you might say Audio Slave.
Because
you had the members of Rage Against the Machine and the singer from Soundgarden.
Yeah, yeah.
But so I'd never... This is consists of rappers E-I-L-P or E-I-P, Killer Mike. I don't really... Is that L or an I? I don't know! But, you know, the same sort of thing for me is, like, if this is a group who are very political, and they really are... This is, I think, their most political album. And occasionally you catch a word here or there or a phrase, and you go, okay, they're talking about something quite political here.
Yes.
But I really struggle to understand what they're saying as well.
Mm.
So it's like when people say to me, I can't listen to death metal because I don't know what they're saying.
Yeah.
I get that.
Yeah, yeah.
Rap, well, I don't know what they're saying.
Yeah.
And these guys... are a little harder to on the harder to understand spectrum than say someone like Kendrick Lamar,
yes,
who we talked a little about last week with, you know, a song like Humble,
yeah,
which is very popular. He's very successful at the moment. He's doing the Black Panthers,
Panther soundtrack.
I can actually understand what he's saying because he's a little, the way he rhymes is a little slower, I guess, or more. He speaks is more pronounced.
More enunciation.
So, but that said, I enjoy just losing myself in the music.
Mm.
And while I suspect I would get more out of what they're saying a lot of the time if I could understand exactly what they were saying, and I had more time like to actually listen to it over and over and over again, more than a couple of times I had to listen to it this week.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you might go, oh, okay, well, I really appreciate what they're saying.
Mm.
A few times I was able to understand it, I'm like, yeah, I'm on board with that.
Yeah.
I mean, they released this album for free. in 2016 on their website. Venethyst, a bit like Trent Reznor does now with Nine Inch Nails sometimes. Mm. He'll release albums in the past. He said, pay whatever you want for this.
Yeah.
Which basically can say zero.
Yeah.
but then if you want, and it'll be MP3s or FLAC or whatever you want, but then you can go out and buy the physical version on vinyl or deluxe editions. Or like when I got the new record late last year, I got funky schematic poster thing.
That's right, yeah.
And a t-shirt. So he's trying, being an established artist, is trying new ways of marketing his music, and Run the Jewels seem to doing something similar. Yes, you can download the MP3s for free. If you want a physical copy or whatever, you obviously can buy it. I guess being a super group, they get away with that kind of thing. I really think the best song on the record for me is the third single, which is Legend Has It. Just track 3.
Yes.
Which is the one that's in the Black Panther soundtrack at the moment. The latest trailer. Into the spotlight.
Of course, yeah.
Very, very catchy. And I think I also very much enjoyed Kill Your Masters, which featured Zach Della Rocca from Rage Against the Machine. He just keeps popping up.
Yep.
Which he just pop up with the actual Rage Against the Machine guys.
it would be good.
Record something new, Zach, for fuck's sake. It's been fucking 20 years.
But, I would never have just kind of been casually flicking through iTunes going, oh, yeah, you know what? Why not? I like the fact that I enjoyed it. And, what was that other band?
That's the same thing, Prophets of Rage.
Yes. Similar thing where I had to concentrate because it was really interesting.
There's another super example of a super group.
Okay,
you've got the Rhythm Section, Rage Against the Machine, Chuck D from Public Enemy, and of course, Be Real from Cypress Hill. That's a perfect example. And also, a very political, more rock influence probably than this, but hip-hoppy, rocky sort of...
It was just so interesting, and I don't normally listen to music to be interested. I just put it on for...
To ignore it.
Noise, and to ignore it, and to just kind of have it there, or just to casually influence me if I'm writing or something like that, you know, something with a rocky soundtrack if I'm doing some action.
Or if you're in an office with the air conditioning switched off.
So I really, really appreciate this. I'm tempted to sort of like check out the rest of the other two Run the Jewels albums and just kind of see if it resonates with me in a similar way.
I'd like to just shout out to my friend Richard, who I'd never heard of his band before about 2.5 weeks ago. We went and saw them live here in Melbourne.
Okay.
And he was posting about how he thought he wasn't the whitest or oldest guy in the audience. and he was pleased by that.
I'm relevant!
Yeah. So it was a little bit like, okay, and he really quite liked him, and he gave him, obviously, you know, their political, and I'm like, okay, well, I'll listen to a couple of their tracks on YouTube, and I kind of liked it, and I thought,
okay,
let's check it out. We as I sort of said, we should probably extend ourselves at people who are listening. It's hard at my age to discover new music.
Yes.
You know, like, I don't listen to stations, radio. I don't listen to radio station at all anymore. I listen to audiobooks and podcasts on the way to work. So you, obviously, you've got your Apple Music, and that's a way for you to discover new music. I don't really have that opportunity anymore. I get personal recommendations, and that's about it. So with that said, I did get a personal recommendation this week.
Okay.
For an artist who, I'm just going to check their name now, Fever Ray.
Fever Ray. I knew the name.
They are probably best known, I think, at the moment, they do the theme song for Vikings.
Okay.
So the album is... Let me just get that up. Yes, I think that's the one we want. It's the most recent one. It just came out in October last year, Plunge. So it is a Karen Dreyer. It's a her, not a them. I'm sorry. That's how much I know. But this is what I kind of like, though. It's like someone says to me, I really like this record.
Yeah.
And you go, it's like I did with Aldous Hardy. You go, okay, let's just go find it. Let's listen to it. Aldous Hardy, Gothic Folk, wasn't for us.
Yeah.
Robin and Jules, maybe.
Yeah.
Let's check out Fever Ray next week.
Cool.
And you know,
I'm doing a bit of a search. I want to find. I do like my blues. I'm gonna try. And find
by all means, I don't want to dominate this segment, but I just sort of thought that was one that I listened to a couple of tracks on YouTube, and I thought, actually, you know what, this isn't terrible. So I am cheating a little bit. So I know enough to go. It's not as terrible. It's not the new Nickelback record. So, you know, but I kind of want, if you guys are listening, it's like, and this segment should hopefully be a way for you guys who are listening to maybe explore,
maybe experience something new.
And so, like, yeah. Run the Jewels record wasn't new. That's been out for over a year.
Yeah.
This one's been out for about 4 or 5 months, and maybe you're sitting there going, oh, duh, how have you not heard of Fever Ray? That's so hot right now. you know, like, I'll see, like,
it's so hot right now.
I'll see Coachella lineups, like, festival lineups, and you'd be like, heard of them. I've heard of four bands.
I feel like when you post those things quite often, it's like, oh, is he playing music bingo? So he's kind of like, yep. Got the line! Woohoo!
I've heard of more than five acts. And they'd be like, oh my God, but they're so good. And they're like, so you'll be like, you go past the poster on the side of a road. You're like, so-and-so playing the Maya Music Bowl. And you'd be like, now that's, for those who aren't familiar, that's a large venue, outdoor venue here in Melbourne, Australia. And you're like, they must be quite big to headline a show there.
Yeah.
Never heard of them.
I find it funny when I see some of those things and it's like an artist I don't know and it's like featuring a band that was famous. And I'm like, fuck, they're the opening act? Who is this other guy? I mean, I had the same thing with when we watched the Super Bowl and Bruno Mars and he was opened with the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And I'm like, The Chili Peppers aren't big enough to do that show on their own anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay. All right.
Sam Smith was on telly the other night on the project here in.
Oh yes.
And it's a name I'm familiar with because he did the song for the most recent Bourne film.
Yeah.
And it was fucking awful.
Yes.
Fucking awful. Considering Radiohead did a song for that or put up a song for it, and they said no.
Yeah. There's a whole bunch that I know, people put them up and are like, how did you say no to this?
And you said, yeah, but I think Sam Smith might have won an Oscar for that.
He did.
So they were saying on the show that he won an Oscar. Jeez. And I was asking him, you know, the usual standard questions they ask a visiting pop star, who quite a big pop star now, Sam Smith. And they were like, how do you go getting recognized in the street?
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow. So he's one of the biggest pop stars in the world, an Academy Award winner, I believe. And
award winner for best achievement in music written for a motion picture. Yep.
And so that would be the song he did for Spectre.
Yeah.
And you'd be like, wow, I could walk past that guy in the street and I wouldn't pause.
Yep. I had the same thing with Thom Yorke. Didn't know who he was. Just thought he was a very depressed dude.
Wow, I mean, that's kind of impressive. I mean, Radiohead were kind of a big deal. When was this?
This must have been 15 years ago.
So we were pretty big rock stars by that point in time.
But I knew of them. I knew them.
But you know what they look like. They don't make a lot of film clips of him front and center.
Yeah.
If you're not buying music magazines and watching MTV, you're probably back then when they actually had music.
At the same time, I did go crazy for Sex Machine when I saw him walking down the street.
Danny Trejo. No, that's
the other one.
Tom Savini.
Yes. I just saw him randomly walking down the street. So I was like, oh my God, Sex Machine! He's like, hi! And everyone else was looking at me like, who's this guy?
He's a legend of zombie films.
Yeah.
He also did all the makeup and effects for Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah.
He was one of the bikers. He gets killed in that film. He's fucking Tom Savini. He was on The Simpsons.
Yeah, he's a name. He's a name, people.
I've been we talked last week a little bit about State of Decay, which is actually one of the houses is the Savini residence. There's also the Kirkman residence.
Very nice.
So you go, oh, I see what you did there.
Shay had one, tragically, my partner at school. She, on her bag, she's got a David Bowie pin. And one of the kids went, who's that? David Bowie.
Well, in fairness, where would you encounter him if you were a child today?
Labyrinth. Everyone should be... That is how everyone finds out about sexuality.
Yes, well, that's what I've said on many occasions. But yes, well, and it's not exactly current.
Sex Ed with David Bowie.
It's not exactly current. It was 25 years ago, wasn't it?
Some things are timeless.
Well, I wouldn't argue with that. And on that note, have we got anything else for this week?
No, I think we'll end it.
We're talking about David Bowie's pants again.
On that note, thank you once again for listening in. Don't forget, you can contact us via the Facebook group at facebook.com/group/FriedBrainProductions or on Twitter at EvilTrav, at TheFriedBrain.
At Kirk Cameron.
At Kirk Cameron, yes. At Real Donald Trump. Just make sure you put in hashtag armchair producers. He'll understand. You can go to patreon.com/frybrainproductions if you want to, if you think we have earned a dollar for you, and that's a dollar for the month. So you get 4 episodes a week earlier than the standard podcast services. So
and
I do appreciate it.
The armchair flops.
Our armchair flops will be coming very soon.
So that's something to look forward to. That could be up to 5.
Yes.
In a month.
Yeah, exactly. 5 in a month. And we may even kind of, if we have people actually subscribe to it, maybe Google Hangout or something like that.
I think that would be fun. It'd be a Google Hangout. We can watch these the flops together.
Yes, I like that plan. So there you go, people. Thank you so much. We will see you next.
Goodbye. Time.